Welcome to the Golden Nuggets podcast, episode 8. Wow. We have We have CJ DePalma here, Dr. CJ DePalma, my co-host, and then a very special guest, Dr. Derek Miles. He is on the pain and rehab team of Barbell Medicine. He and Dr. Michael Ray have a pain and rehab seminar that goes out. I attended the first and last in-person one in Boston. Super fun. He also was the co-founder of the Logic of Rehab, which was one of the initial stimuli for me to change my views, and was an original bully on the Clinical Athlete Forum, which was another very challenging time in my life.
You and Mike.
Yeah. Ugh. Oh my goodness. But we invited Derek on to talk about injury as a general topic because it is quite confusing. Derek, thank you so much for coming on.
Yeah. Thank you for having me.
We are very confused by injury. We're hoping to figure out, because it's something that gets talked about a significant amount. I was listening to a podcast today and they were talking about injury as if it was just this like one thing. And as I've delved further and deeper into the research and definition of nebulous terms that I try and use in daily life, I have found that this one is quite complicated. What do you think, in your opinion, what is injury?
Well, I don't know if I'm going to give you a much better handle on this, because if anything, I think it's going to muddy the water. It turns out it's all contingent upon who you ask. And even then, when you're reading research papers on injury risk or injury prevalence, a lot of times there's not a good definition associated with it. And if that is the case, it turns out it's really hard to interpret the findings of the research. And if you really start getting into it, there was a consensus statement from a few years back where they started kind of trying to create some definitions, and they came up with two to really have as operational. One being time loss as any physical complaint resulting in time loss from training or competition. And the second being physical symptoms. And this one, as I read the definition, is kind of hilarious if we really think about its applicability to especially like barbell athletes. And it's any physical complaint of pain sustained by a player resulting from a match or training, irrespective of the need for medical attention or time loss from activity. And so basically, like, are you sore? Okay, well, by definition, that would constitute an injury. And I think we start seeing this kind of extrapolated in how things are presented on the internet as well, especially in kind of the fitness and rehab side of things, to where if you cast this really wide net, then everyone is quote unquote injured, and therefore there needs to be some type of intervention. And there's also this expectation that, you know, training should feel good. And that's not necessarily the way it should be, because if you're trying to stress the system to get better, like, it's not going to be comfortable all the time. I think some of it that got me down this rabbit hole is the only professional sport I'm remotely interested in is hockey. And I think the way hockey tracks injuries is, the way they track injuries is hilarious, because it's qualified as either concussion, upper extremity, or lower extremity. And those are your three options. And like, when we look at how things are displayed, especially in the rehab world, I mean, there are quote unquote injuries that don't even exist because people unicorn up some stuff for them.
I like that.
Yeah.
That's good.
Yeah. It's my favorite of the fictitious.
How many of those toothpicks do you have left?
I have no idea. I bought one pack. I have no idea how many was in them. And I think they're like copulating in my kitchen drawer and just somehow expanding.
Maybe Kim's ordering, like, just, yeah. She's just like, this is what makes him happy. I'm not going to question it. I'm just going to order him more unicorn toothpicks. So I think one of the things that makes me confused the most about injury is that there's almost more than one thing that has to happen for it to be an injury. Like, it can't just be that you have pain, and it can't just be that you're taking time away from training, because those two things in and of themselves don't seem to almost encapsulate what pain or what injury is. But then there's also seemingly like it has to also be happening for this duration of time to be this type of injury as well. How can people use it so cavalier? I don't understand.
Well, I think what it comes down to is how much the person or that's in control of the situation would constitute as being an injury. There was also a study by Bowling that asked athletes, coaches, and physical therapists to define a sports injury. I think it would come to no surprise to most of the listeners that everyone answered it differently. And it mostly was in the context of the individual themselves. If it was interfering with the athlete's training, then they considered themselves injured. If the coach couldn't get the athlete to perform at the level that they wanted them to, then there may be some discussion around this. And, you know, physical therapists, we can turn anything into a problem if given enough time. So
I went to school, right? Isn't that what school is for?
Yeah.
Just kidding.
Problems over solutions.
Right. Right. So you guys are deeply well more versed than in this topic than I am. After Mike almost made me quit the profession 4 years ago, right when I started, I really shifted into this mindset. And then I quickly was exhausted and have moved to focusing more on coaching and performance. It's less daunting and it's less meta, I guess. It is, but in the sense of it's positive, right? And there's just we're just helping people get fitter and things like that. But I think defining it is like a NASCAR race, right? We're just going to keep running in circles for a really long time. And I enjoy NASCAR. That wasn't a dig at NASCAR. That
I
was
like NASCAR
the
only too,
thing,
man.
This is the only thing that would kind of. So I think the question.
Raise hail, praise Dale.
Needs to be more so of how do we address a situation, whether that be a situation where they have pain, whether the situation where they are limited in training or they believe that they're injured, outside of just trying to meta them into, you know, moving that needle. And I think that's where we don't have to go there yet, but that's where I'd like to go with this conversation at some point. And I know it's very specific to the situation at hand and all those things, but I think it's just something good that we can conversate about. You know, we all have different focuses. Derek, you're still in the clinic more, and Joe has just a little bit different approach than I do. And then, you know, I work more performance, and we still all deal with pain on a regular basis. So we do have some young PT students that listen to this. And so I'd like to give them at least some direction instead of just saying nothing you learn in school is really valuable.
I don't think that's the case at all. And what's funny about it is I do think you can turn this into this super meta philosophical thing, but really what it comes down to as an athlete or a coach is this question of, do I need to change or modify my plan? And I think if you operate off of that just simple paradigm, then you're really 90% of the way there. And, you know, one of the things we really talk about at Barbell Medicine is the whole pain doesn't necessarily equal damage side of things. And that is a whole different meta thing that I would rather not go down today. But in the same regard, when we're talking about certain types of injuries, there's almost the other side of the spectrum to where you do have to understand risk. And the example that I see a lot of times is after a muscle injury or what's typically called a strain, because most of the time those athletes feel better pretty quickly. Right. But what we know about the physiological healing, it takes a little bit of time to build some of that strength back, and you are at an increased risk of getting sustaining a re-injury. So you do have to understand probability in overall risk. And even there, it gets into some really interesting conversations, because, you know, we're all taught that, or in PT school, we're taught that, like, how long does it take a ligament to heal? How long does it take a muscle to heal? It, as though, like, you know, it's like your 18th birthday and all of a sudden all these freedoms open up after you cross this threshold. And it's way more complex than that. And if you've been in the field, CJ, I know you have to be familiar with this, like things like, when's your next competition? How important is this next competition? Like, that's all going to factor in.
Sure.
Like, and, you know, my kind of specialty at this point is youth sports. And the conversation I get to have a lot of times is like, is it really worth the increased risk to go win your intramural middle school seventh grade softball tournament?
Scouts are there, man.
Yeah.
Yeah. Said that on the golf course today.
Well, it's, but it really comes down to, you know, once again, what do I need to change? What is the inherent risk in me doing this? And there, even it gets into kind of the conversation of injury between two different definitions, one being like incidence of injury. So the number of new cases over time, or how often does this happen, versus prevalence, which is how many people have it currently. And I think that gets misconstrued a little bit as well. So, you know, how likely is it this to happen, or like how prevalent is it to happen at a certain point in time?
And this seems to be a difficult thing in and of itself to try and figure out. I mean, it's almost like bringing us back to, how do we figure out how many people are injured if there's different definitions, and that definition is kind of a subjective thing and it changes from sport to sport. And then how can we, it's also a difficult one. It's like, how can we predict how often these people are going to get injured when it's, again, a complex happening that we can't just use a reductionist way of looking at it?
Well, there are certain things that we see increase risk. And once again, you have to be able to think in terms of what that really means. Like, if I look at the average person and I say, I could double your odds of winning the lottery, shouldn't go out and buy a lottery ticket on that information. But, you know, if you have a 30% increase in risk of injury if you go have this behavior, and we're already have a couple other yellow flags in place, well, maybe we need to change that behavior. And the classic example that I would go to out of this was the whole movement towards the FMS about 15 years ago. And there was one paper that showed that military recruits, I'm going to be a little off on my numbers here, but close enough for the point, had like a 20% increase in risk if they fell below that arbitrary 14 line. But the overall prevalence was like one in 10,000 hours of training. So like, okay, so you went to 1.2 in 10,000 hours of training, and we're investing how much money in getting everyone certified, and how much time and performing this on everyone. Like, it just, our yield on that, there's 100,000 better things that could have been done with the time, as opposed to telling someone that their inline lunge all of a sudden wasn't up to snuff, even though their sport or activity of life does not require that position at all.
I could never do the same side bird dog.
It's not easy.
I don't know anybody that could.
CJ, yeah. I mean, if you're trying to make a good screen and you're wanting to sell something, you need to have some components that don't want to do. Yeah.
Yep.
Is there a place for screening, let's say, in like pre-sport participation?
I mean, it depends on what you're talking about. I think having a conversation regarding, like, how's your sleep? How's your stress? And what's funny about it is, even you'll hear a lot of PTs talk about screening strength, and then they're talking about a manual muscle test.
Right.
And like, well, I don't care. Like, you're not going to tell me how strong someone is from a manual muscle test. And now if you're going to take some athletes through on an IceConnect dynamometer, like, all right, I'll listen a little bit. Like, we might be able to pick up, but it still goes down to, how much do you modify what's going on?
Sure.
And even then, you almost have to look at it as, where did this occur as a point in time? At my first job, we did a lot of screening on Division I athletes across all sports. And basically, if you could test it, we were doing it. Well, research got published on this, and it did show, unsurprisingly, that there wasn't anything that was really predictive. But there was almost a meta conversation there, because we would always do this at the start of their season. So you just took athletes who are coming out of the offseason, they're 2 weeks into their sport, they're beat to hell because they've been doing two-a-days, and then we're going to come in and poke and prod and have them do all these movements. And, you know, sometimes we're there till 10:30, 11 o'clock at night running these athletes through a biomechanics lab. Like, it's just, even within the context of it, you know, I was telling you before I got on here, I've been renovating a bathroom for the past 3 days. I'm sore in muscles I didn't know existed. I'm not injured right now, but I also felt no desire to go deadlift or squat today because I have far exceeded my physical activity recommendations.
Sure. I think that kind of rolls into my question. Me and Joe, I don't know, we don't really butt heads on anything, but we might not agree 100% on this. Is like, when do you, this isn't on our pre-approved list of topics. So, when do you shift? Because I know you do performance coaching in general, correct? Mm-hmm. Like with Barb, right? So when do you take the shift from like, let's just move squatting, whatever, without regards to like strict, any type of strict movement standards? Like, when do you make that shift? Like, when is it important? What kind of situation are you looking for to like correct someone's squat or correct someone's deadlift, in the sense of like moving them towards that, the subjective visual, you know, thing that we think is right?
Well, that's a phenomenal question. And I think it is a good gray area between performance and rehab, because I'm sure both of you have done this. You've had an athlete and you watch them squat and you're like, that looks great. Now, could you have corrected or coached out like seven other things? But I know how their squat looked 2 weeks ago and this looks better. Therefore, I think that's great. We're working in the direction of where we need to be. Mm-hmm. Now, if you've displayed the same thing for, you know, 4 weeks, we probably touched on it at week two, and at week four, we're definitely putting something in. Mm-hmm. Some of this is like, it's that coach athlete relationship too. And I really think that's why you see this push towards more interdisciplinary approaches and, you know, actually getting to know the athlete in front of you. And, you know, we made it however long into this podcast before I said it depends the first time. But sure. If I have an athlete who, yesterday I had a guy who admitted, he was like, I started running a training program and basically I was running every session to RPE 9 and 10 on my lifts.
Money. Like,
all right, we are going to intervene on this behavior immediately.
Sure. Yeah.
Whereas like I have a youth athlete who I'm coaching right now, who like from where he was 3 weeks ago, he's crushing it. And I mean, it's still like, if I put him up on an Instagram page, odds are I'm going to get some people trolling in the comments section, sure. But they don't know where he was 3 weeks ago.
Right.
Yeah. And I think knowing how and when to give cues and how many cues is definitely something that is difficult to learn, because you just want to give a bunch of cues at once and be like, just fix all of it. Just, I don't know what you're doing, but fix all of these things at once. And almost trying to toe the line between making them afraid to do those things that you're telling them not to, thinking that it's coming from my coach, I shouldn't be doing that because it's bad for this reason. And so I feel like that can be.
Well, and I think part of the problem when you're a novice coach or a younger coach, especially if you came through the lens of PT school or Cairo school, is you want to say everything you want to work on at once. And it turns out it's really hard to think about four cues and pick up 500 pounds. Yep. And so you end up just creating problems for the athlete because you just made lifting a cognitive task instead of a physical task.
So what the other side of that extreme, what's problematic about giving no cues and just saying you're moving through space, who cares? You'll be all right.
I mean, I have some athletes that that's how I do it because they're fine. And I think sometimes I'm going to attribute this to Roderick Henderson. And I don't know if it was him originally, but he's who I heard it first. He said, coaches, we all want to be Batman talking about all the tools in our toolbox, but our role is to be Alfred. And I think that is such a beautiful explanation, because really a lot of our roles as coaches or even as therapists is to be the one who sits there and goes, this might not be a good idea.
Right.
And you know full well that Batman's going to go out and do some stuff that frankly is probably not advisable, but it's just, when do I need to intervene on this?
Yeah. I think one of the main things that CJ and I do is just hit the brakes for people.
Yes. You know?
So, man, just 90%. So I have a few athletes right now, I'm going to hijack this, but super high level CrossFitter. And she has back pain when she goes like balls to the walls, but she can train like 90% normal. She just can't handle high volume squatting under fatigue or running, right? Probably due to some like excessive fatigue in the back, and it just blows up, right? And she's like, why does my back blow up? I'm like, it just doesn't tolerate these high volume things. And she's like, well, what are we going to do to fix it? I'm like, well, we're just going to build the tolerance. We're just going to slow dose for till you start to tolerate it well. And then we build up and then we pull back down. And so it's just for her, it's just like, nothing is wrong. Like, so in like the definition of injury, like I would never, cause she's asymptomatic 100%, except like super high volume front squats paired with burpees or something like that. Right. And so how can we define that someone like that is injured when they're asymptomatic 98% of their life? Nothing bothers them except this very specific pairing of movement patterns.
Or how can we say you have some sort of movement abnormality in your lumbar spine when you get to here? And well, that's why you're having.
Yeah, she was perfect. I can't even like coach her in the sense of like a technical thing, which I try and do with all of my rehab athletes, because I want to kind of give them a dual reasoning to stay on for performance and things. But technically, like, she's super sound. And so, sorry to mean to hijack it again, but yeah, I mean, it's like these situations are really interesting. It kind of plays into this whole topic. Like, just putting the brakes on is probably best, but yeah, anyways.
Well, even there, like, I think that's a great example, because if this athlete had the games coming up, and I mean, let's face it, there's going to be some high volume squatting in there, yep, then technically she might classify as injured at that point.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Like, if you're a wide receiver in the NFL and you have turf toe and you can jog all day long, but you can't sprint and cut, right, you're injured.
Sure.
You can't perform your job, even if there is just that one thing. And I think it is getting in that like task and goal specific. And the problem is, a lot of us normies like to pretend we're elite athletes, and we're like, well, so I can't do this one thing. I can't back squat this week. Okay. Like, cool. There are literally an infinite number of ways that we can exercise that don't involve a back squat. You don't have a competition coming up. Like, yeah, this isn't the end of the world. And that individual I wouldn't say is injured. And like, yeah, we probably just need to work around this for a little while.
Yeah. Agreed. So at that point, what are you saying to the individual? How are you conveying this to them? Because everyone we work with, right, especially like traditional sport athletes, they come from like such a mechanical.
This is my next question as well.
Yeah. Reasoning, right? They come from such a mechanical reasoning. Like, even the CrossFitters, maybe a little bit less, you know, because they're newer to fitness and activity most of the time, right? But like, the mechanical has such deep roots, right, in orthopedic surgery and like old school methods, right? There's just so much, what's called like old money, right, in the sense, mm-hmm, there. Like, how do you convey that to them that, you know, we're not doing anything different? We're just maybe, I don't know, I don't want to answer mine because I know how I do it. I want to hear how you do it. So.
Well, once again, it often depends on the relationship I have with the athlete, because, you know, you guys know me well enough to know I tend to leave my forehead sometimes. And if I'm familiar with the athlete, like, I'm going to go straight at it. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I have certainly said things to the effect of, well, that's stupid, or where did that come from? And I also have a few very high level athletes that like I've coached for years in certain capacities, and like they fly to different states to go have individuals do things that I laugh at. And sure. With that, with those athletes, like as long as they come in, they do the things that I ask of them, they know I think it's BS, but it does nothing for our overall coaching relationship to sit there and like ask me about it or, you know, delve into it. So I don't care. And so I think it depends on the individual itself. And, you know, once again, I think this is one of those, like we treat in the society things. And I think sometimes as therapists, we forget that our relationships with the athlete, with the physicians around us, with, you know, the ATs at school and, you know, all these individuals we co-interact with all influences this. Because when I was at Stanford Children's, it was great from the interdisciplinary relationships because I knew my physicians really well. I knew what was being said to the athlete. I knew the ATs at a lot of the schools. So like, you know what each party's saying. And there it's a little bit easier to jump into the deep end really fast. Whereas moving to a new town where some things are being conveyed to athletes that are frankly just wrong, like I don't have the relationships with those physicians yet to where I can I can challenge them. So like I'm tiptoeing around a little bit more.
You should try leading with your forehead in those conversations.
I've done that. It typically doesn't end well. You know, it's one of those things where I think in PT school or just rehab professions in general, we get taught all of this like diagnostic stuff and we forget that ultimately this is a sales job. Like,
I've been yelled at. I'm sorry to interrupt. I've been yelled at so many times by like clinicians that are older than me about saying that. And I've said that from the beginning. And like, I came and opened my own thing and did my own thing right away. But it is buy-in and relationship, like you said. Like, I just can't resonate with that enough. And I've said that from day one, that this is a sales job. Like, if they're bought in, you're going to win. Like, the outcomes are just going to be just better.
We think about it like, so let's say that I'm omniscient. I've read every research article in the history of ever, and I have a complete understanding of what's going on. If I can't convince you to do the thing you need to do, I'm worthless. Mm-hmm. Now, and I think that point is lost on a lot of, especially very structuralist clinicians. Like, in back to the sales job, like, I think if you really want to build those relationships, you need to be in the business of solutions and not problems. And sometimes that solution is like, hey, buddy, you're going to be okay. Or like, carry on. And we come in and it's like, well, I saw this person walking down the street and they had a Trendelenburg gait and I felt like I needed to go say something. No, like that person needs to go live their life and you need to leave them alone and then go read the research on how there isn't really a correlation there with your perceived hip tap after weakness. Like, and I think really the more you read and the more you kind of run into that like existential crisis when you get into being into practice for a few years and reading research, it's not that these things don't matter. It's that they don't matter as much as you think they do. And that second part of the sentence is really the imperative part. And it's not that if we fix your knee valgus, all of a sudden you're bulletproof, which I had to pause to not use profanity in front of saying that, but like it's.
We're not a clean show. It's fine.
Okay, well then it's you just opened up
my mom's going to complain, but
yeah. Well, but really we like thinking that if we fix X, it automatically intervenes on Y. But the problem is there were 23 letters in the alphabet before we ever got to X. Ooh. And like
if my job, that was a good one.
Well, what's funny is I think I actually got the number right on that. Yeah,
you did.
Yeah. But really, this is one of those things, whenever I teach my ACL lecture, it's hilarious how much we talk about like how much the quad matters. And, you know, I think we're checking a lot of boxes now on turning the ship, but we forget that like we weren't the ones performing the surgery. We don't know what their home life is like. Are they going to be able to make it to their PT appointments? Like, in it's one of those things, like, I don't care if you're the greatest therapist in the world, if the surgeon performing it sucks, like, good luck, buddy. And so I love thinking I can intervene and I can influence outcomes, but there are going to be huge hurdles that are going to sway it one way or another. And I've been fortunate at two of the places I've employed or been employed to have phenomenal surgeons around me. And like, it makes life easier. I'll tell you. And when you start seeing some of the things from some outside perspectives, like it's crazy. And CJ, like my mentor at Florida and myself used to talk about this all the time when it came to recruiting, because I was there when Florida was extremely dominant. And we would talk about, you know, you would get this collegiate strength coach come in from different programs and they think that they have the magic thing that is producing these phenomenal athletes. Like, dude, I handed you a 6'6", 300-pound dude with a 42-inch vertical. Like, if you give me anything else back, you suck. And I think those initial conditions are lost on a lot of people.
Sure.
100%. And it gives this like false sense of how good we are. And like, if you're working with very high level athletes, I could easily see how like it could give you the sense of like, oh, I'm great because I have these awesome outcomes. Nah, dude. Like all those letters before X spelled out amazing athlete, and you just got handed the last little bit of this.
Right. Yep. This person's been through all of these selection processes that selected out everybody else that wouldn't have performed at that level or been able to handle all that stuff. And you're just like, it was me. I hit him with a hammer and now he's better.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I've, you know, again, really consistent, you know, like as like the space that I'm in, this like private pay CrossFit setting, right? Highly motivated people, usually not that injured, hardly ever an acute response, right? Or like a traumatic anything. And even then it's more fear than anything. Like my outcomes as like a clinician and the people I've worked with have been ridiculous just because everyone wants to get better. And I see people in such good situations, right? Or the ones that have finally left the insurance world and came to see me have really tried everything else, and their regression from the mean and natural history is probably doing way more work and having way more influence than me specifically, right? I just might be like another variant of like the kitchen sink that's been thrown at them to that point. And my whole goal is to just like get them in the right mindset, like, hey, it's going to be okay, you know? And so, which is probably the only thing they haven't heard up to that point, if they're coming to see me and they've been through the rigmarole of like the traditional system. But yeah, I was a volunteer strength coach, and that was the route I was going to go prior to PT school at South Alabama, which is like a low D1 school. And I was there. They went 19-0 their first 2 years, but they had 3-star players, and we in the gym, they made so many changes. They turned some freaks into some real freaks. And then what Justin Swin, great mind. He was like, dude, 5-star players get 5-star results. That's why Alabama produces 700-pound squatters every 7 minutes, because they walk in there with 680 pounds with no training. Right. And you're just like, oh, 5-star players get 5-star results, man. That's just like, that's it. Yeah.
But the funny part about it is then it's almost the, like, so this is actually a phenomenal conversation regarding injury, because sometimes there is this mentality of we have these, the statement I would always say to my mentor was, if I hand you diamonds, you need to return diamonds. Mm-hmm. And the problem is that sometimes we get in these situations where the person has diamonds and they just crush them. And like, when you look at a lot of these elite programs, like, mm-hmm. It basically, if I were going to do a case study on survivorship bias, I think some of these would be where you could do it. It's not necessarily that you produce the best, you just had the best, and a third of them washed out due to the strain put on them, and what's left had great results. And it just is this whole, and if you've worked in collegiate athletics at all, you see these kind of themes of injuries every year. And even when we're talking about like incidence and prevalence data, it's, you have to take it in the context, because so if I do a study and I'm going to look at ACL tears in one high school, well, that doesn't really give me a good picture of general population, because odds are if you're in that same high school, you're all training in a similar fashion. So is it the chicken or the egg? You know, is it really a quote unquote biomechanical factor, or the fact that like nobody in your school lifts, or, you know, some factor like that? And even beyond that, like there was a great study, and I actually put up in the notes that you had sent me from Hamlin in Australia, where they looked at injury incidents over the course of a school year in collegiate athletes. And it's hilarious to see the data, because what you see is this spike in the preseason. And then there actually is a little bit of a correlation between when their semester breaks and holidays were and injury. So they would, you know, have a week off, come back and have that spike back in their load, and you saw injury tick up. There's a study from Elliott that was a 10-year incidence of hamstring injuries in the NFL. And if you look at it, like, have you ever seen data that's so clean that you're like, they cooked the books on this? And this is one of those studies. And it basically showed that if you get past like week six of the preseason, the odds of you suffering a hamstring injury go down dramatically. And we're talking about elite athletes, but we're also talking about athletes that are coming out of their off season and going to training 10 hours a day. Mm-hmm. So it's not because they have an anterior pelvic tilt or whatever we're going to assign it to. God. It's like, turns out if you go sprint for 6 hours a day, especially if you're trying to make a roster and you're really trying to go balls out, like you're at an increased risk of having some things happen. And, you know, this whole, we're going to pin it down to this one thing, it is just so hilariously dumb. And I guess hilariously dumb, that is the definition of tragic. So let's say it's just so tragic. Because it misses the person in front of you for whatever joint or joint force you're wanting to talk about. And it's asinine is the only way I know to say it. I think part of where it really comes down to is gets back to these relationships. Like I have athletes that I've coached for a long time now, and some of them, if they tell me something's hurt, we're having a long conversation because they never say anything. Right. And then other ones, like, I mean, I had one athlete who I worked with for a long time, who's probably one of my favorite athletes ever. And I would joke with her that she could bitch as much as she wanted to whenever she was training, so long as she came in and did the work. And it's just those relationships. Like I knew her well enough to where I was like, you need to unload when you're here. Now, this same athlete was a swimmer, and there were times where she would come in so beat up, and we were supposed to have a training session. And there was more than one occasion where I sent her home and told her to go to sleep. There was nothing we were going to do at the gym that day that was going to supersede her putting her head on a pillow and getting 8 hours of sleep. And I think that is that whole, you know, we're going to grind, we're going to go hard. Cool. Well, what are you doing to manage your stress?
Right. I think this is a good segue into like looking at some of the different things that can contribute to injury or happen in that sphere, because like I don't want to call it allostatic load, because I feel like people aren't going to know what that means, but like general life stress, right? I think that one of the things that kind of ticked off this idea of the complexity of injury for me was understanding the complexity of pain and looking at people through like a BPS type lens, is that not only does pain sit in that realm, but so does the rest of their existence and injury as well. And so I think that a really cool kind of niche of research is like mental readiness for return to sport, which seems to be something that can, you might have to correct me on this, but can kind of predict how they'll do when they return, or their prevalence of risk or risk of re-injury. Is that a thing?
Well, it's more just the likelihood of them returning is really what it comes down to. Like, it turns out that if you're not ready to go back to sport, you don't go back to sport.
Right.
And once again, this kind of gets even back to the sales conversation of like, I can get your limb symmetry index to, you know, beautiful levels and turn you into the Vitruvian Man, but if you're still scared to go out there and play, you're not going to go play.
Sure.
But yeah, then it comes down to even like knowing how to address that. And it turns out like the way I've explained this in the past, especially when I'm talking to clinicians, like when we're talking about the mental game, like all you need to do is build confidence. Well, cool. When Kim and I are in a fight, all she needs to do is calm down. The worst way for me to elicit that response is to tell her to calm down. Like, and you know, it's, if it were that simple, I would never have slept on a couch. Like, it is this whole, like, you have to know how to take these like steps. And it's almost a trick to where you can't show your hand. And I feel like with my personality, I have trouble like treating people that I'm close friends with, because it's like, well, you know what you're going to get out of it. So there's no magic to it. Like one of my friends, Josh Barabbas, he said this probably 10 years ago. And I think it's like the greatest therapy statement of all time. It's like, you'll never be able to treat anyone who's seen you naked. And like, I think there is some truth to that, to where like, when you start talking about like, we all talk about trying to have these conversations with our family members, and you're like, well, there's no way my mom's going to listen to me no matter if I had every answer under the sun.
Yep.
And I think there has to be a little bit of that like prestige to it, to steal a term from magic, of like a little bit of like showmanship side. And you know, CJ, I'm sure, and you said it a minute ago, like your job and my job typically are made easier by the fact that people seek us out. So like, we're already steps ahead, mm-hmm. versus the therapists that are dealing with those individuals that are like, well, go to rehab, it's not going to work, but we need to check this box before we do whatever next. I'm like, well, good luck, like you got a hole to dig out of.
Sure.
I think, CJ, one of the first things I asked you when I started driving down to Pensacola was, have you ever had somebody that, I guess, like blew up in your face? And you're like, not really. I mean, these people search for me and they come here knowing what they're going to get. And I have not really had a poor outcome yet.
Yeah. Yeah. Like one, I mean, I definitely have people that like, you know, it took a long time, you know, but I think one that like sticks out, we went through like a few sessions and like, I think it just felt like she just had like a sour taste in her mouth as soon as she walked into like everything that we did. Like, I mean, she had low back pain, and every single thing that we did was just like, meh, doesn't feel better. And just like it was so hard to set a precedence and like an expectation with her, like just very closed off. And so I think that personally, I think sometimes, you know, we can talk about the way that we view some of these things, and for sure we have a huge bias to like how it should be, and like letting research maybe excessively dictate the direction we go, and I don't know, and I've struggled with that a little bit, but it is what it is, you know. And I've been very fortunate to have that kind of experience in the profession.
Well, and I think one of the things that was really influential for me early on was, on weekends to pay down student loans, I worked trauma call. And when you're in the hospital working with trauma patients, and you know, you see the dude who had a completely open femoral fracture and is hopping down the hall like nothing happened. And then you go back to work on Monday and you see somebody who, you know, once again has low back pain only when they're doing one specific thing, is living the rest of their life perfectly fine. Like you're like, well, these two people have entirely different trajectories, but the response is so different. And it gets back to a little bit of even a like coaching conversation of like, what is hard? And it turns out, you know, if you live a pretty easy life, it doesn't take much to knock you off. But like in the problem there is, you know, to use all of the metaphors I like to throw out, like, you know, we wake up and we watch College Game Day on Saturday mornings during football season. And there's like always that story. It's like, well, Billy's dad left when he was 8 years old. His mom was hooked on heroin. He was picked up by the coach and who took him under his wing. But then he was mugged at 16 and had a knee injury as a result. But he persevered and came back. And now he has a D1 scholarship to wherever. You're like, go Billy. But like if they ran one on Saturday morning, it's like, Johnny was born to Olympic gold medalist parents. He went to an Ivy League all boys school. He married his high school sweetheart. He drives a Lamborghini. Like all of us are like, screw Billy. Like that dude sucks. But then you turn the question around and you're like, okay, well, which athlete would you rather be?
Sure.
And no one's going to pick the hard way out of that. Yeah. And, but it is those, that adversity that really does develop us into who we are. And I think like, even regarding the injury side, like it is that, is this stopping me enough to where I need to change what I'm doing? And the more reps you get having that conversation, I think the more it gets dialed in. Like it's the little niggle here and there, like, all right, like it happens. That's life. And it's not that you're injured or there's anything really like quote unquote wrong. It's just how we're presenting the scenario in front of us.
Yeah. It's pretty interesting when you talk to people who don't like just the lay population, and they think that there's almost like this threshold or like this bottom like floor that they have to hit before they can do some movement, or they have to do it with some amount of weight or something like that. And when you tell them you can do box squat with, you know, a 10-pound, you know, dumbbell and still be all right in the eyes of the universe, it can be quite a freeing experience.
Well, it's one of my favorite coaching cues is I love it when you get the athletes that really want a lot of feedback, and you'll have an athlete like squat and then turn around and be like, how'd that look? And my favorite response is, well, did I say anything? If I didn't say anything, it looked fine. Like it is like almost that reassurance through silence.
Oh yeah. For sure.
I kind of have a question based on that. How can we implement the eyeball test without it getting too like different coach to coach or too subjective coach to coach? Like CJ says all the time, and I shake my head every time because I don't understand how to use this. He says they move great or they move shitty. I don't know how to do that when there, I guess, isn't a goal or there isn't a movement standard or something like that. Maybe CJ, you can weigh in after Derek, or I just don't know how to use the eyeball.
I think this is one of those instances where it is really important to have reps. And CJ, you said you interned with a strength program. Like I've done the same thing and did my residency under Tim Shea, who's still one of the greatest humans alive, in my opinion. And really he would say a lot, and I say this to like young clinicians that I'm coaching and working with, it is the like, my goal as an instructor is not to teach you everything I know. It's to lessen the number of mistakes you had to make before you get beyond me. And I don't think you can do it by yourself to figure out if it's a good movement or a shitty movement. Like you have to go back and forth with certain people and have those conversations on what it entails. And sure. Even there, like some of it is also kind of knowing your personality and realizing that you're not going to be able to work with everybody. Like one of my co-therapists at Stanford Children's is one of the nicest humans to ever walk the face of the planet. There are certain athletes that were much better working with Tim because they needed a little bit more like TLC and they're and it would, but that's not bad. It's just your personality. Sure. Whereas like the people that came in a little bit more pigheaded, well, it turns out I'm pretty good at working with those because I'm kind of that way myself. And like, if we would have an evaluation and one of us was like, hey, this person's probably better off working with you. It wasn't that either one of us is a better therapist. It's just realizing where the personality needs to go.
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
So, yeah, kind of similar question. What do you mean that looks good or doesn't look good?
Yeah. And so I think they're sort of hit on it. But it was like reps, right? You know, it's like, I'm still looking 95% of the time now, when you hear me cue and correct somebody, it's because their goal is performance, right? Their goal is to be more efficient in the movement pattern, moving towards the goal. I know they want to be, because they all want to look like, you know, Liu Xiaojun when they do a snatch, right? Okay, well, I know exactly what that looks like, and I know what it takes to look like that. And I can move people from where they are of doing a clean, thinking it's a snatch, right? Just like completely oblivious to the barbell itself, towards that direction. And so that's the only time you almost, and you know this, when it comes to pain and someone's like, my knee hurts and they squat, most of the time I'm not correcting them, right? I'm like, hey, I don't think your squat is directed, you know, is causing your knee pain. I think the pattern of knee flexion under load is probably what's causing pain. So let's just offload the knee for a little bit, right? At that point, right? And so context is very important, right? And so like Derek said, it's just reps, dude. I've been watching and coaching movement consistently for like 14 years. Like I coached baseball when I was like in high school and I was like starting to get into weight training then. And I've been, you know, like I've had like every certification under the sun throughout undergrad. And so like the reps are just there. I mean, you know, I'm only 30 and like half my life I've been coaching someone, whether that's like the guy next to me squatting with me that day, my fraternity brother or whatever it was. And so we're never coaching them to like, hey, I think you're going to hurt yourself the way you're doing this. Cause dude, I've seen some people move some crazy amount of weight, just dog shit. Like, just like, God, I hate you. Cause I feel like I move pretty well. And I'm just like, man, I'm stuck at, you know, 60% less than this athlete. And so, so I think that's like where it is. And so I think the question comes to Derek, are you coaching performance? Are you being specific cueing to like changing someone's squat, right? So like where does that start? Where do you care? And like how do you move someone without like instilling fear, I guess, or like this apprehensive to like the postural kind of statement?
Mm-hmm. Well, it is, what's funny about it is just listening to you talk there. I don't think anyone, you know, everyone comes out and they're like, I want to get this certification, I want to learn all of this, I want all the information now. And nobody wants to get smart slow. And mm-hmm. It is just taking the time to do all those boring reps. And like, I got to the point where I would start trying to pull over some of the young clinicians when I would have video check-ins mm-hmm. and show them the video and be like, so what would you do here? Like, let's talk through this. Let's go through the reasoning on why or I did or did not say anything right here. And like, trust me, it's really boring to have that conversation when I know I'm not going to do anything, but it's mm-hmm. reps they need to have.
Sure. Yeah, and me and Joe had this conversation this morning.
CJ asked me that shit today. I got serious. Yeah, I was like, don't ask me. Just tell me.
What would you change? And I was like,
tell me what's wrong.
It was someone snatch. And we went over it. It's exactly what we did. And God, I can't count how many snatch videos I've seen.
Well, it's, oh God, it's, I like, I was actually thinking the other day that I wondered if like I've performed more squats or watched more squats at this point.
Oh, I've definitely watched more squats for it's, sure. Without and, question.
Well, I'm way older than you. It is that whole, like mm-hmm. you just sit here and you think about like just the overall repetitions that you have. And even there, like it's almost a conversation even regarding some of the rehab side of things. And, you know, you get the kids that come out that just graduated and they don't know anything about anything. Like, I'm going to open up my own private one-on-one concierge place in Pensacola, Florida. And,
hardcore.
But as I got into that, I was like, man, this is really low hanging fruit.
All right.
But in the same regard, you had coached before. So you at least had some background out of it. And on top of that, like, you were asking a lot of questions as a young clinician. But like, if I go into this high volume clinic, and I'm not saying like 25 patients a day, but let's just turn it into a math problem. Let's say that you come out and you see one-on-one six patients a day. And I go into an academic clinic and I'm averaging 12 patients a day. I'm literally getting twice as many reps as you are.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when we're talking about training, what's the conversation that comes out a lot? It's like, so what's your overall volume of this? And like, well, it turns out I have like, I'm getting 2 years of volume for every year of volume, mm-hmm. which even statistically means I see more like outlier cases.
Sure.
Like if you're seeing a 1 in 1,000 in, you know, 6 patients a day, it would take you 3 years to see one of those. Whereas I may see 1 in 1.5 years.
Right.
And it's just, you know, people don't think about it in terms of like just that exposure. And I think some of this, like, I'm acutely aware of because I'm married to a physician going through residency and fellowship, to where like she works 80 hours a week on average. And it is just like getting the reps. And like, once again, nobody wants to show up and do the boring stuff.
Yep. Yeah, I feel you there. Yeah. Yeah. I think that kind of rolls into, so we have 3 coaches in the company, or 4 other coaches, and programming, right? Like writing programming, right? Like, yeah, I've read so many things on, you know, like just stress recovery, adaptation and periodization and conjugate methods and phasing and, you know, and CrossFit is the worst sport on the planet to program for, because it's, you know, 8 individual modalities.
Be good at every movement.
One. Right. And so, and a lot of people are like, how do you program for CrossFit? I'm like, dude, it's just reps, man. Like, you just, especially when like the whole goal is to kind of be creative and pairing movement pairings and things like that outside of like your linear progressions of like, okay, you can't do a muscle up, you can't do a pull up. Okay, let's start there and linear move you this way while working on all these other things. And so, you're right, man. Reps are so key with all of it. But yeah.
Well, I need my 30-minute workout. Okay, that's cool. You're never going to be a great athlete. Like, right. And people don't realize like really how much just time it takes in order to do it. And so right now, from where like my current situation is, I'm doing most everything through barbell medicine. Mm-hmm. And I've been training like 2.5 hours a day because I have time to do it. And it's not me like throwing out singles at 9 every day. It's, you know, I rode a 90 minute piece the other day for the first time in God knows how long.
You rode 90 minutes straight?
Yeah.
Eric was a collegiate rower.
I didn't know that. You didn't get off. Yeah. Did you get off the rower? Were you numb? No. Was your butt numb?
No, dude. I think when this kind of is the same, like, what is hard conversation.
Sure.
When you've been a collegiate rower and you just spend so many hours on the erg, like I can just zone out and it's, you go to that dark spot and you come out and you're like, oh, it's, you know, we've all driven home before and been like, how did I get here? Like that's basically what erging becomes at a certain point.
I miss rowing. And I wish I had a rower. CJ, you knew I rowed, right?
Yeah.
Derek, I think this might be a good spot to talk about muscle imbalance. Regarding,
is it really a good spot to start?
I mean, just really quick, and then we'll be done. All right,
let's keep it specific.
Yes,
to rowing. Okay?
As somebody who turned one direction for the duration of your rowing career, did it have any effect on how often you got injured?
No.
Okay, cool.
I weirdly never had an injury rowing, when you look at just in, I realized like that sentence is kind of paradoxical to this entire conversation. When you look at, like, the sheer volume of work I was doing, plus if you know a collegiate rower, we weren't exactly living the healthiest lifestyle most of the time. But we just tolerated it because, like, I mean, I still, for all the shenanigans I got into, I did do a pretty good job of sleep. So I guess I had that box checked. But like, but I think this also like shaped a lot because like I was a starboard rower my entire collegiate career. Like I am the antithesis of Zoolander. Like I only turn left. And when you start doing some of these screening things, like it was hilarious when people would be like trunk rotation and like, I can turn around and look behind me to the left side and can't do nearly as much on the right side. And everybody like, you have all these problems. Like you didn't even ask anything else before you told me I had a problem. Like if you show me a rower that is like a sweep rower that's symmetrical, I'm willing to bet I can show you a crappy rower.
Yeah.
Sure. Oh yeah, definitely.
You just haven't felt the repercussions of that yet, but down the line.
My favorite one is, so I had a disc herniation with motor weakness in my quad. And so I had like legit, like a 65% deficit, like a few months after, because I did test it on ice kinetic dynamometer. And I mean, if you have that kind of deficit, you're going to shift. And sure. Felt fine, was back to training. But like, if you had me do a bodyweight squat, I shifted over to my left side. And this was early enough in my career to where I was still going to a lot of the like courses you need to go to as a new grad, where they're talking about like squat technique and doing stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And it almost became a joke that I would wait for the instructor to come around and be like, you're shifting over to the left. We need to fix that. And like, no one ever asked like,
sure.
Hey, why might you be shifting over to the left? Because if so, like I knew the answer, there right. was no amount of cueing that's going to fix a 6 month, 60% quad deficit.
Yep.
And like, it was just hilarious from a technical component. But I also think like, once again, to the Billy and Johnny thing, like, you know, having some of these setbacks as far as injuries goes, made me a better therapist because I'm like, well, I didn't change anything. So do I really need to have this like, complete overhaul of everything going on?
Sure. Well, CJ's right, we've been going for a long time. CJ, I thought of a nice ending question. Did you?
Yeah.
Unless you thought
no, I you told me, so I didn't
think of it. Okay, Derek, we'd be remiss if we didn't talk about cooking with adhesions with you here. My question to you is, as somebody who's trying to get into the knife game, do you have a specific type of knife that you are go to? Are you like a knife block kind of guy, or do you have one Japanese Nikiri that you go to, or what?
So a lot of that's a phenomenal question, and you're probably going to get way more of a complex answer than this.
question.
Yeah, so a lot of Japanese knives are handed, and so they actually only have the blade is sharpened on one side. I'm a lefty, so I mean, if you know anything, we hate scissors. And so Japanese knives are completely out for me, which sucks because a lot of them are beautiful knives. I think everyone should have an 8-inch chef's knife. If you have that, you're like, you can do just about everything. John Hodges got me a like pretty nice custom made knife that holds an edge spectacularly. And that is definitely like, if I sharpen it, I could shave with it without issue. But this also is kind of an interesting conversation regarding like just doing the boring work, because if you want to talk about something that is like a necessary thing to do, it is sharpening your knives. It's also like boring because you're just sitting there with a whetstone. Yeah, go for it, CJ.
Oh, I was going to raise my hand. Sorry. So I feel like I try to sharpen my knife, and I worked in a kitchen for a little bit, but it was like more of like, I threw pizzas. And so like our knife, like we would cut like deli meat and stuff. Like, so we didn't really, I mean, they were sharp and the guys there knew how. So give me the 30 second elevator of how to best sharpen my knife.
Get a whetstone and okay. Start with a coarse grain, and then you're really,
the,
So what's funny is I actually have some threads with some people where we just discuss some of the weird nuance of knife sharpening. And it is like a technique conversation.
Yeah.
Because like, if you ask 10 chefs, you're going to get 10 different answers.
Okay.
And I like to just draw the blade across part. And it seems like my perception is a lot more of the Japanese chefs do more of the circular motion. Mm-hmm. And I just don't like it, because I would rather just sit there, and it's probably because I am a lifter and I just get used to counting things. I'll just sit there and get 10 strokes, switch the blade, 10 strokes, and just go back and forth. But if you have like a 400 grain stone, like you're not going to be like paper thin slicing tomatoes, but right. It'll keep your knife sharp. Sure. But I also think like it is this conversation of, are you willing to sit there for 30 minutes and sharpen your knives?
Is that how long it takes? Wait, so one knife, how many strokes, like how long should it be taking me? Okay, this is my last question.
So it depends on how hardcore I'm going, because probably once a year, I'll take all three of my chef's knives all the way through down to a honing stone. And I mean, I think that one's like, 3,000 grit. I mean, it's something like very smooth, but mm-hmm. after I do that, like I can slice paper. Right. But that, to sharpen all three of them, probably an hour, maybe a little bit longer by the time I'm done. Okay. So,
got it.
But cool. Some of it too is normally like I'll like put on a podcast or like blast some music and just sit there and do it. And it is just like, I need to get the reps in.
I love it.
Sure.
Yeah.
Very cool. Well, Derek, we really appreciate all of the insight, all of the analogies, and the cooking with adhesions. If you don't follow Derek's Instagram, his story is lit all the time. And when he does post, it's always fantastic. Derek, where can people find you on the interwebs?
If you want to email me, I'm Derek@barbellmedicine.com. I occasionally am on Twitter at DmilesPT, and then on Instagram at Derek_barbellmedicine.
Cool. Thank you very much. CJ, anything?
No, that was great. Cool. That was a good conversation.
Have a great time, everybody. Thanks for listening again, and we'll see you next time.